It's a great pleasure to introduce you to our reviewers of the future. This is Professor John Beattie, a distinguished Africanist and anthropologist, author of a number of books, including Bring Your Own African Kingdom, Other Cultures, which we're told should have been Other Culture, Understanding an African Kingdom, and other works. He was born in 1915 and educated at Dublin and Oxford. John, the first question I wanted to ask you was, how is it that you were, I believe, a background in philosophy, came to be interested in and study anthropology?
Well, there are two prongs, I think, related to this decision, if indeed you could call it a decision. First of all, having read philosophy in Dublin, which the philosophy in Dublin is a kind of course in the history of philosophy rather than a perspective look at modern developments and so on. This I found stimulating, interesting, to study ideas, concepts, arguments, and so on. Then from Dublin, I went into the then British colonial service and went to Tanzania, as Tanganyika as it then was, and spent 8 years as an administrator in the colonial government. And this, of course, involved getting to know, work with Africans. And after 8 years, the war had intervened, but I had stayed in East Africa. I had about a year's earned leave due to me, and the question then arose what to do with this leave before going back, as I then saw it, and continuing to be an administrative officer. After much thought, I and a colleague, John Rennie, now Sir John Rennie, decided, since he was in the same position as I was, that it would be very nice to go back to England and spend that year reading anthropology, which, as I said, my interest in which had derived from these two sources. So we did that, and we came to Oxford again, very much by hazard. I think this could be confirmed. I think, in the streets of Dar es Salaam, while we were ruminating on this point, we met an anthropologist called Stanner, W.H. Stanner, who at that time was making an ethnographic survey of East Africa. So we said, where should we go to study social anthropology? And he said, hesitating, Oxford is the place to go. So we said, all right. So we wrote to Oxford and were duly accepted on the strength of having quite good degrees to begin with. And so I began to read social anthropology as a diploma student during leave. As the year passed by, it became more and more plain to me that if I could move into this field of work rather than remain a district commissioner, this would be the thing for me. And I'd also become married by that time, and my wife was a musician, thought that living in England and playing cello would be more interesting than living in the bush and not staying at all. So that is how the decision was taken. So then the question you also asked, I think, why I went to Uganda rather than anywhere else. Well, the answer to that is, again, a matter of hazard, because I had really wanted to go to a people in Tanzania whom I knew quite well, or fairly well, called Baha. Partly because, as an administrative officer, I had spent some time in the secretariat as secretary of a thing called the Governor's Appeal Board, which had appeals from murder cases and so forth, in which had arisen in consequence of witchcraft or other issues of this kind. And anyhow, the background here was interesting, but it so happened that when I discussed this with the then director of the Institute of East African Institute of Social Research at McKinley, who was then Audrey Richards, who was in the center, she said, or she wrote rather, because I hadn't met her at that time, that this country that I wanted to go to, Buha, was already being studied by a Dutch anthropologist. But wouldn't I would like to go somewhere else? She thought that Bunyoro might be a jolly good idea. It was a very large and important kingdom. It had long traditional history. It was, although not as important as neighbouring Bugande, it was still many claims to prestige, antiquity, and so on. So I said, all right, why not? And so I decided, so I went to Bunyoro. Things followed on from there.
When you, perhaps before we talk about Bunyoro, which is fascinating, could I ask, you came to Oxford. Who were the people who taught you when you did your diploma, was it?
When I did my diploma, yes. I was taught by Evans Pritchard, at least I attended his lectures. Maya Fortes, who was there for the diploma year, then he came to Cambridge after that. And my supervisor was an anthropologist called John Peristiani, who is still happily alive. He was a lawyer by training, French by background, Egyptian, Greek by origin. And jointly with this colleague of mine I mentioned, John Rennie, we had a joint session, joint seminars, in which we discussed almost everything except social anthropology. The chap was very interested in history, law, and Greece, and so on. So we had many exciting conversations, but they had very little bearing on anthropology, which is in a way rather characteristic of anthropology itself, much of which doesn't seem to be very characteristic of anthropology anyway. That would be rather an obscure remark, but I think you can follow
the gist of it. Who do you think among those people, or anyone else, influenced you most in your later clinical work?
May I answer the question you haven't asked? I've heard and attended the lectures of Radcliffe Brown long before all this, before the diploma thing arose, because I should have mentioned that part of the training for being a civil servant, going into civil servant in those days was, of course, in anthropology at a fairly simple level. And I used to do this course myself with colonial cadets for the few years that remained of my colonial world after, colonial rule after I had become an anthropologist. So Radcliffe Brown did make an impression on me, and partly because coming from a philosophy course in Dublin, this was in 1939, Radcliffe Brown's writing and talking and lecturing had at that time the same brilliance and clarity that his writing had. I mean, it turned out that not much of it was mistaken. I wrote a part of Radcliffe Brown in Church of Fathers, which I give my views, but he was a strong influence and continued to be so. Evans Pritchard, with whom I worked and with whom I became a close friend, I think I may say, over many years in Oxford, was also a very powerful influence, again with his clarity of mind, his breadth of interest, and his sheer personality as well as his scholarship. In all these ways, he was an outstanding figure, and I was really privileged to have worked with him, under as his pupil first and then as his colleague.
Yes. So those are the two people who influenced you most probably.
Yes, I think so.
So you think Evans Pritchard is a fascinating and complex character. Is there anything that you remember most strongly about him? I only met him once or twice, but...
Yes, well, that's right. I knew him as a friend, I knew him quite well because we lived quite close to each other. We both had small children at this period of growing up and went to school, so I very often used to take his children to school, and he would sometimes take mine to school, sort of mid-joint expeditions. And so we were always early in the institute because we had to be early with anybody else because we had children to deposit to schools on our way there. I remember him over all these years as genial. He was a strong social person in many ways. And at the same time, those who know him will remember that he certainly also could have a sharp tongue with Christopher and colleagues. And I remember he used to rib people rather, and if they were the sort of people who didn't mind being ribbed, then they got on like a house on fire. If they did, then his Pritchard would say, well, he's not or something. So that, yes, he was always lively, he was always exciting to be with in some way or another. In his later years, things became difficult for him. He was ill much of the time. He lost his wife tragically in some years earlier from that. But, and other than that, it's hard to single out particular incidents. I think I might just say one thing about my coming into anthropology, because it does fit in. This is rather characteristic of him. When I did the diploma, going back to that again, and when I thought what I would like to abandon colonial service and become a social anthropologist, I went to EP, and I remember this moment in his shady garden, and then we sat there and I said, I'd like to discuss something with him. He said, okay. So I said, now, if on the basis of my performance in the diploma and so on, do you think, I know I can't ask you this question, I've tried, but what would your view be to taking up becoming an associate anthropologist professionally. And I can remember even to this day he'd be saying, he went around and he said, obviously I can't give you direct advice in this matter, I would only say one thing, and that is that if you do decide to become an anthropologist, I'll give you my very fullest support, which I think is a generous thing to say, and many other people, well, a few other people whom I've consulted, also academics, I said, don't give up your splendid job at the colonial service, if you want security and so on, even though there's another few years, of course, that would have collapsed completely. So I acted more wisely than I thought. This was another hazard, but less of a hazard than one might have thought it would be in the circumstances. So he was forthright, E.P. was, said what he meant, said what he thought, and it was basically, I think it should also be said, he was basically a very generous and kind person, but this was not always immediately manifest.
Could I turn back to the field work, to the Nuro?
Yes.
When you went there, on Audrey's instructions,
advice.
I sometimes get the
well, I think,
to,
yes.
The instructive people work.
Well, there was an element of instruction, perhaps, yes.
What sort of people did you find, and what interested you most about them?
You mean before I went there?
No, when you arrived.
In Bunoro?
Yes.
Well, my original interest in them, I think, attraction for students. I think here, again, past and present fit, different pasts fit together in some measure, because as an administrator, I had obviously been interested, because I've had been interested, but it's not so, in power, control, authority, structure of authority, and so on, in the system of indirect rule under which Tanganyika then was in war days. So when I went to do fieldwork, the first problems I formulated, in fact, what I worked on this little bit from my BNIT, were problems about the exercise of power and control of it in indigenous mechanisms, whereby that can be restrained and not even be abused any more than possible, perhaps, and so on. So the theme of authority and its structure, and so on, I'd read Max Weber and so on by this time, so I had some idea of what it was all about. This was what I think made me feel that studying an ancient kingdom, even though still well under colonial government for 50 years of war at that time, would be a rewarding and exciting thing to do, bringing together interests which I had carried with me from Tanzania into the new scene where I was interested in other aspects of the country besides the political one. So in Bunyoro, I put on record, and then you mentioned my small book on fieldwork, I think, how one carries out a field study in those conditions, which of course have changed greatly since then, although I still think some of the approaches which I adopted would be and are still relevant. I took time off to begin to see people who might be helpful, missionaries on the European side, the district commissioner. I think I knew from my background that how to deal with irate or indignant or otherwise difficult Europeans and others. So I did take pains to be polite to officials on both of the native government, as it was then called, on the one hand, and the superimposed West European administration on the other hand. And I discussed my research with them and so forth. One theme which I think of some interest perhaps in the context of how to go about it in a centralized traditional state was where to begin one's research. And of course, I'd spent my first few weeks at the district headquarters talking to the king himself, the Mukama, who kindly gave him some time, his chief ministers, his native government's chiefs, and so on. And they all said, you can stay here, we'll take care, we'll teach you everything you want to know about your culture, and so on. So I said, I listened to this, but I had already made up my mind that the way to do anthropology, partly because of my teaching, was to go and find a village with inverted commas and live in it and observe everything that went on and get to know its inhabitants well and get to understand their relationships, their kinship systems, beliefs and all this on this kind of basis. When I put this to the Mukama and his colleagues, you can learn about our culture, you don't go into the jungle and talk to all these uneducated people. What's the point of that? So I think I was quite succeeding in persuading them, but I was adamant and carried on, and in the end, while they did the hummed and hawed, in the end I think they saw the point, because I learned the language never to anything approaching perfection, but sufficient to use it in everyday work. By living in a village and talking nothing else except Swahili, which some other people knew, and I already knew from my administrative days, but that was still a Bantu language. So after 6 months or so, I have made reasonable progress and sufficient to write to people and talk to them and so on. So I, keying into his advices, began to see that there was some point in it all. So I anticipated a little bit, settled down, did this village, spent 6 months or so in this particular community, got to know it well, and carried on from there, staying in other places, getting to know people, and so on.
What do you think, looking back, do you think is your most, on that stretch, was your most original contribution theoretically, from either arising from that work or?
Well, I wish I could think of one.
It's almost difficult to think of one.
I think in this case it may be impossible.
What excited you most when you discovered it?
Well, several things really. I suppose I was very interested, of course, as the time went on, in the ritual side of things, and in your symbolism, and in the Eastern practices and rituals, which seemed to call for particular interest. And a particular interest was a cult of spirit mediumship, which again is very widely found throughout and large. But part of the challenge here was that the Banyoro themselves, who had been subject to intense repression by missionaries and to some extent by the European government in matters of ritual, were therefore extremely reluctant to say anything whatever about it. And I remember one occasion when, quite early on, I was talking with my neighbours in this first village, tonight, of course, and I had to take it very, very gradually. I said, what about witches and sorcery? They would all look at other spots. And they would deny they never had such thing in their country. And then on Christmas Day, my first Christmas Day in the field, I went to the local church with a few of my neighbours, next door neighbours, one or two others, and the church was a tiny little grass hut about half the size of this room that we're sitting in. And I knew enough to hear a little bit of what the preacher, who was a lay Munyoro clergyman, preacher, he wasn't a clergyman, he was a member of the church, Church Missionary Society. And I heard his sermon, him saying that the people should leave their spirits and things and come and mend the church roof, which indeed was still very much in need of mending, having huge holes in it. So when I got out of it, rubbing my hands, I said to my friends and colleagues that I'd gone with, did you hear what he said about leaving your spirits, cults and whatnot, and going mending the church roof? Without turning a hair, they said, oh, he must be talking about some other community, which he wasn't referring to us at all. This is what I was up against for quite a long time. Finally, I did make a bit of a breakthrough and got to information about cults and got to know people who had participated in them and to participate in them to myself. So, yes, one more. You asked me, this research that I did on these cults was probably, has more claim to originality than anything else was at that time. Much work has been done since that time. I think we should emphasize perhaps that this field work was carried out in the early 1950s. I've been back since, but not as much as I would like to have been, nor did I ever really get back into research and everything. So, things quite a long time ago. I don't think I would want to add anything. I did a lot of time on the political structure of the kingdom. I did put together a book called The Nyoro State, which is a bit more comprehensive than the paperbacks mentioned. But again, I wouldn't claim. I might say something. I have pulled on my work really in terms of what were the major contributions.
Well, there have been many, John, in a more characteristic and modest way on the plate. But can I just, as we've got a few seconds left, ask you a final question, which is whether you would be an anthropologist again if you had the choice?
Oh, categorically, yes, and more so if possible is the short answer to that. The experience of working with and learning to understand, as far as one may, another community is, I think, uniquely rewarding. And I'm sure the same applies to somebody who devotes their life to study French culture or any other culture. I think this is, or cultures, I think this is the rewards are there. There's discomfort, and in my case, very little discomfort. I can tell you a story about that as well, which I'll throw some time.
Well, tell us in a second, but perhaps we should end by thanking you very much indeed for talking to us. Thank you, John.
Thank you for the attention.